Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Institute for Government. My name's Hannah White, and I'm the director of the IFG, and it's great to see everyone here and also joining us online for this general election series event on how the parties can improve ethical standards in government. Now, I don't think anyone can have failed to notice that ethics and standards has been quite a big theme of this last parliament. We've had both quite a number of individual cases of ethical breaches by individual politicians, but also a big political high-profile issue in the case of Partygate, which of course led to Boris Johnson leaving government. So we thought it'd be really interesting and important to have a discussion about how we should think about these issues looking at the next election and the possible outcome of that, what the parties are thinking and planning to do, what their proposals are. Of course, with Boris Johnson having departed as Prime Minister, this issue sort of moved down a little bit in terms of political salience, but there's been a steady drumbeat of more individual cases since that time, which have kept the profile high, and from a whole range of different politicians, backbenchers, frontbenchers, and of different parties. So it's, a really important issue. And we've been doing some work on it here at the IFG, and we're delighted that we have an excellent panel here today to discuss the question. Before I hand over to my colleague, Tim Durrant, who leads our minister's work, but is also the author of our most recent report, Rebuilding Trust in Public Life, so highly salient to this event, who's going to present some of the findings of some polling we did on public attitudes to standards in Parliament. I just want to introduce the panel, and what we're going to do is have a brief presentation from Tim and then have a panel discussion before we hand over to all of you for your questions. If you're online, you'll be able to send those in through Slido, which should have come up on your screen. If you're here at the IFG, you'll be able to ask them directly. So, to introduce the panel, starting on my right, we have Esther Webber, who is the senior UK correspondent for Politico. Before she worked for Politico, when I first met Esther, she was a political reporter for The Times, and she broke many stories, including on Brexit, Whitehall, and indeed on bullying and harassment in Parliament. Then we have, excuse me, Nick Thomas-Simmons, who's been the Labour MP for Torvine since May 2015, and since September last year has been Shadow Minister Without Portfolio in the Cabinet Office with responsibility for some of these issues. On my left, Sir Jeremy Wright MP, who has been Conservative MP for Kenilworth and Southam since 2005, former Attorney General, former Secretary of State for Digital Culture, Media and Sport, and between 2019 and 2022, a member of the Committee on Standards in Public Life, a role he just told me he's rather missing since he stepped down. And then Tim, I have already introduced. So as I say, we're going to kick off with Tim, and then we'll move to a panel discussion.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Hannah, and thank you everyone for being here. So I will just do a short presentation on our recent paper that Hannah mentioned. But before I do, I thought it's worth just kind of recapping some of the events that have led to this issue being such a kind of important topic in public life. This isn't all of them, and they're not all related. There are lots of different things that happened. They fall under different regimes of rules and ethical setups. But I think the last few years have really led to a sense that the systems set up to kind of guide ethical behaviour in public life are not working. And this has been a big piece of work that the IFG has been doing for the last few years, working out how this can improve. And I know there are lots of other organisations, some of whom are in the room, who've also been thinking about this topic. So what we did for this report in February, we did some polling, which was with Ipsos. It's representative of the GB population. And you can see all of the numbers on our website. We started by looking backwards over the current parliament. So we asked people whether they thought that people in the current government behave according to high ethical standards. And around a quarter think that they do, and around two-thirds disagree with that statement. We then asked people whether they think standards of behaviour have improved since the 2019 election through to February of this year. or whether it's got worse, or if there's little difference. Only 15% thought things had got better, a third thought there was no change, and almost half thought things had got worse. So almost half thinking things have got worse, I think, is quite noteworthy. But for me, the most interesting thing is the third of people who think there's no change. They might mean they think it's always been this good, or they might mean they think it's always been this bad. But the fact that they don't think there's change, I think, shows that this isn't just a story of the last few years. This is a story of a kind of disengagement or lack of trust in politics more generally, which I think is important to us all. We then looked ahead and asked people to think about after the next election, and we asked them to imagine that the Conservatives won the next election and how much people would trust that Conservative government to behave according to high ethical standards. These results are broken down by their 2019 vote, so there's a lot of information there, but I'll just pick out a few points. You can see, unsurprisingly, it breaks down broadly by party support. So 2019 Conservatives were more likely than any other group to think that a post-24 Conservative government would behave ethically. Even that group, though, more than half of them did not trust a future Conservative government to behave according to these standards. And the total score, only a quarter of people, 26%, thought that that Conservative government would do so. We then asked the same question for a Labour government, imagining a Labour government after the next election, and again, broken down by party vote in 2019. Unsurprisingly, Labour supporters much more trusting of the Labour Party than they were Conservatives. Conservatives much less, well, broadly the same almost, but the population at large, 45% of people trusting a future hypothetical Labour government to behave according to these high standards. So broader, higher expectations perhaps of Labour, but still a very decent proportion of people who do not trust them to do so. The final question we asked was imagining if people had a preferred candidate in their constituency, if that person were found to have broken ethical rules, so whether that was bullying or expenses or misleading Parliament or so on, how that would affect their vote. And again, a lot of information there, but I'll just pick out a few points. So if you look at the total bar, 26% of people, a quarter, say that that would change who they would vote for. We were just discussing this next door. That's obviously not a majority by any means. It's you know, only a quarter, but it's a quite significant number, I think. We weren't sure what we would get out of this, and to see a quarter of people saying that they would change their vote because of ethical standards, I think, is interesting. But the fact that 74% of people would choose other options suggests that this is not the only factor in people's decision on votes. The other things I'll pick out, the Conservative 2019 voters were more likely to sort of stay with their preferred candidate, which of course might not be a Conservative this time around, but that's who they voted for last time. And the Liberal Democrats were the biggest group. Liberal Democrats in 2019 were the most likely to change their vote, which I think is interesting. So that's what we found from our polling. What do we think the next government should do about it? We've set out various recommendations, which we think any Prime Minister, whether that's Rishi Sunak coming back or Keir Starmer, could do. And some of them we think are relatively straightforward, quick wins. The first one, we think, and we're not alone in this, think there should be a new ministerial code. Part of the problem, we think, with the current ministerial code is that it elides basic things about processes of government, so who can attend which cabinet committee, how ministerial cars are used, with ethics and standards about not bullying your civil servants or not using government property for party political reasons. And that, we think, leads to this kind of hue and cry. Whenever anyone is accused of any potential breach of the ministerial code, people are calling for their resignation, which we don't think is helpful. There are plenty of cases where people have potentially or actually breached the ministerial code that we don't think require a resignation. And actually being clear on that, separating that out, will just make the debate on this issue better informed. Second, and perhaps most importantly, again, lots of people have said this, we're not alone, the Prime Minister's independent advisor, Sir Laurie Magnus, does not currently have the power to start an investigation on any issue around ministerial standards that he sees fit without getting the PM's permission. The PM has said he would expect to give that permission, but it is still a step in the process, and we think that they should not have to go through that step. And it'll be interesting to see what the Labour proposals for the Independent Ethics Commission does on that role. And then finally, quite quickly, is requiring ministers to sign a legal deed of undertaking. This is something that the government have committed to already. This is about, for their post-government jobs, ensuring that they stick to the business rules. We were just talking next door, and it'll be interesting to hear Jeremy and Nick's views on this. This is legally complicated, but this is something that the government committed to almost a year ago, and we haven't seen any progress on that. So I think it would be good to understand what the difficulties there are. Secondly, more structural changes. We think there are plenty of things that can be improved in the way government itself works. So again, the government has committed to improving what information it provides about ministerial meetings, hospitality, and so on and so forth in their departmental transparency publications. They were supposed to move from quarterly to monthly. We haven't seen that change yet. I'm sceptical that it'll come in before the election at this point, so we think that's an easy win for the next government. Then, regardless of whether it's the legal deed of undertaking or some other form of enforcement, enforcing the rules on post-government roles, we have seen that the ACABA committee, which Eric Pickles chairs, is pretty toothless. I think Eric Pickles would say so himself. We saw just this week that Boris Johnson has breached the rules yet again. And there is no comeback on that. And then finally, this is a point that Sue Gray made in her capacity as second permanent secretary, when she was investigating the party gate scandal. She made the point that within Whitehall, there are not sufficiently strong and independent routes for whistleblowing for civil servants to raise concerns about what is happening inside government. So if Labour get into government and Sue is back in Downing Street, is that a change that the next government will make? And then finally, legislation. Not all of this needs legislation, but we think there is a benefit to some of it. So setting out the powers of the independent advisor, currently that role doesn't exist in statute at all, and a requirement on the Prime Minister to publish a ministerial code. That is not saying that the content of the code should be in legislation. We think it should be for the Prime Minister to decide what they think the code needs to cover, but the requirement for a code of conduct for civil servants and a code of conduct for special advisers exists in, and I think local councillors as well, exists in law, so we don't see why ministers should be any different. We haven't talked about these last two points, but we think these would be wrapped up in the legislation, and we can talk about them in the discussion if that's helpful. Currently, the Public Appointments Commissioner and the governance code around public appointments exists as an order in council. We think it would benefit from a stronger statutory footing. And lobbying, the lobbying industry, the lobbying representative groups have called for the lobbying register to be extended to in-house lobbyists as well as consultants. We think that would be sensible and would help with some of the concerns around David Cameron's role at Greensill, for example. I will stop there and hand back to the panel, but that's where our publication is, and you can see all of the polling and much more detail on our recommendations on our website. Thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Tim. OK, so we'll move on to the panel discussion now, and I'm going to go straight to you, Nick. There were a few questions that Tim was sort of directing in your direction in the course of his presentation there. I think if you look at the polling, which we presented there, yes, it shows that the public doesn't think much of the current government's track record on ethics, but doesn't necessarily have a great deal of confidence that if there were a future Labour government, that it would do things particularly differently. Now, we've obviously, for some time, heard that the Labour opposition have said in government you would introduce a new Integrity and Ethics Commission. What we haven't heard much about is what that would really do, how you think it would shift the dial in terms of ethics and standards. So what I'm really hoping to hear from you today is the answer to that question.
Well, thank you very much, Hannah, and it's great to be on this panel, and a real thank you to Tim, first of all, for an excellent opening presentation, and indeed for the report. Now, I think the total on those who would trust a Labour government either partially or wholly to act to high ethical standards was around about 46%, I think, was the total in this. But look, I think the British public have always had a healthy scepticism of politicians. But I do think that ethics, integrity, standards are a particular issue at the moment. And that's why when Keir Starmer gave a New Year's speech for 2024, he was setting out that standards in public life would be a high priority for him. Now, he said, of course, politicians should be focused on public service rather than self-interest. I'm sure we'd all agree with that proposition. But we know that there will be challenges in making that a reality. Now, we will at the election put forward a comprehensive plan. We'll call it the Cleaning Up Politics Plan, that will be on things from lobbying to MP second jobs to procurement to foreign donations. But you also need to look at how the rules are monitored and enforced in government. And this brings me to the Ethics and Integrity Commission, which is what, Hannah, I think you are specifically asking me about. Now, we want to bring, the overall aim is to bring a greater coherence to the system for regulating standards in government. And I think you perhaps didn't say it explicitly, but I think you were certainly saying it impliedly, Tim, that the current system is complex and it is very disjointed. You know, we've got ACABA, we've got the Independent Advisor, we've got the Office of the Registrar of Consultant Lobbyists and so on. Now, I understand perfectly why it is. If you look at the history, particularly of the last 30, 40 years, why we've ended up in that situation. But it is difficult, whether it's for the media, ministers themselves, or the public, to understand all these different bodies and their purpose. But I also think it's difficult for regulators to spot common problems in ethical standards, or indeed identify where there's overlap or intersection in particular areas. Now, the Ethics and Integrity Commission is not meant to be a sort of single big super regulator. There are bodies that do require different skills, different people, different powers. So where that's important, we will retain separate committees. But what we do want to do is to bring them all under one roof and create, if you like, a one-stop shop for standards in government. We want to make it more transparent, more accessible, more joined up. And above all, really, try to do the work of restoring public confidence. And I think too often this has been a problem in recent years. I mean, I was shadowing the Home Department when the then, I think it's a couple of Home Secretaries ago now, had been found to have, I think it was bullied inadvertently, I think the report said, civil servants. But forget the content of the report for a minute. Who ended up losing their job? Who ended up walking away from their job? It wasn't the then Home Secretary, it was actually the Independent Advisor who ended up being the person resigning. I mean, I found myself this morning at Cabinet Office questions, but I thought Boris Johnson had long left Parliament, but I find myself asking questions about his latest sort of issue. This time it's ACABA finding that he's broken the business appointment rules, which I'm asking at Cabinet Office questions. And of the recent Prime Ministers, Liz Truss said she wasn't going to appoint an independent advisor at all because she always acted with integrity and it wasn't required. Now, I mean, you can understand why the public, with all these different circumstances, have ended up in the position they do and that Tim has set out. So, of course, we have our specific proposal on an Ethics and Integrity Commission. We, of course, want to look at the rules. But I think you've fundamentally got to understand, I think Tim's presentation makes this clear, that trust in the system is broken, and our aim will be to rebuild it.
Great, that's really useful. In terms of some of the specifics that Tim was putting forward there in his presentation, say, for example, the ability for the independent advisor to initiate his own investigations without having to ask to do that, legal deeds of undertaking for ministers and so on, what are your plans?
So I do think there needs to be the independent ability of start investigations to have investigative powers. I think that's a really important principle for there to be without the specific direction of the Prime Minister. I think that's a very, very important principle. The issue of the deeds of undertaking is, I think, more complex. I think there does need to be a mode of enforcement. Otherwise, there's very little purpose to having the rules if you can't enforce them. But, you know, and I was a barrister in a previous life, and I think the deed of undertaking method that you've suggested, I'm not sure how foolproof it is, to be absolutely frank, speaking frankly. And that's why we're trying to look at different ways in which it could be enforced. Maybe a future project for the IFG there, Hannah, to inform the debate.
Indeed. Well, I mean, the government have already said they would do it, so you would assume that they have some plan of how to do it, but I agree that it's not immediately obvious how to do it. So, yes, I might have to take on that challenge. Jeremy, turning to you, you saw from the polling evidence that, and indeed the examples that Tim put up, there have been a fair few examples of ethical breaches under this Conservative government. But the new Prime Minister, the latest Conservative Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has taken some steps in this regard. What do you think the overall assessment will be of Sunak's approach to ethics and standards?
Yes, well, again, thank you for having me. And I do think it's somewhat inevitable that the party of government gets greater scrutiny on standards matters than the parties in opposition do. That's only appropriate because it's the party in government that holds the power. But I think it is equally not in question that Boris Johnson, when he was Prime Minister, had a particular relationship with the rules that meant that there was an example set from the top that people assumed would flow down the ranks to permeate the entire party of government. I don't happen to think that's true. Perhaps I would say that, wouldn't I? But I don't think that every member of the party of government takes that approach. And I think across Parliament more generally and across governments of all political colours more generally, it is mostly true that people abide by high standards. They seek to behave properly in office. And there are, of course, people who don't in any government of any political colour, but I think the majority generally do. As far as Rishi Sunak is concerned, as I say, I think the example set by the person at the top really matters. I think the tone is set by the Prime Minister in any government. And actually, we've talked a little bit about the ministerial code already. And by the way, I entirely agree it's sensible to separate out the procedural aspects, as Tim was suggesting, of what used to be called questions of procedure for ministers, which became the ministerial code, sensible to separate out those procedural questions from ethical questions. Every prime minister writes their own version of the ministerial code. I don't have any particular objection to putting that on the statute book, by the way, as a requirement, but I think as a matter of fact, I can't think of a recent prime minister who hasn't had a ministerial code, so I don't think it would make very much practical difference. But those ministerial codes or versions of them being drafted by each individual prime minister also matters because it's important that the authority of the prime minister is invested in that document and that every minister who is subscribing to be bound by it recognises that the prime minister takes it seriously and will act accordingly. And Rishi Sunak, I think, has demonstrated that he is prepared to hold people to account in his government for poor ethical behaviour. He hasn't clung on to ministers in the way that his predecessors perhaps did when it was obvious that from a standards point of view they couldn't stay. And I think that tone from the top is distinctly different when Rishi Sunak became Prime Minister compared to, for example, Boris Johnson. So I do think that makes a big difference. Do I think that his report card will be all A's? No, I don't, because I think that there are a number of substantive changes, some of which you've mentioned already, that I think this government should have put in place. I welcome the response to the Committee on Standards in Public Life and others' reports on what needs to be done. And I think some of the things we've mentioned already are on the list of things to be done. I think this government is, well, struggling with lots of other things to do at the moment and will struggle, I think, now to get many of those things done before the general election. Probably worth saying that in that July document that was the response, not just to the report that I and my colleagues on the Committee on Standards in Public Life produced, but also others who produced reports, the Boardman report, I think also a PACAC report on the same ground. It did say in that response, it's going to take a long time to do some of these things. And for some of the reasons Nick's mentioned, these are complex questions that will have to be worked through. So it perhaps isn't surprising that you've had all of these questions addressed already, but I do welcome the recognition that, for example, there should be a ministerial code that gives options to the Prime Minister as to which sanctions they can apply for breaches of the code. That, I think, is a welcome development and is sensible. But it's worth reminding people that that was part of a package that the CSPL presented, not just a pick-and-mix a la carte option where you as a government decide which bit you like and pick that and don't do the rest of it. And the other bits were just as important. And the other bits were, for example, as we've discussed, the independent ministerial advisor, whether they're brought under the roof of a commission or not, doesn't really matter. That person or that group must have the power, as Nick says, to initiate their own inquiries. I think they must also have the power to determine whether breaches of the ministerial code have occurred. It is, of course, for the Prime Minister, as I've said, to write the ministerial code in the first place. And I think democratically it must be for a Prime Minister to decide who serves in their government. So an independent advisor can't say this person must leave government. That must be a Prime Ministerial decision. So I don't think there's too much to be scared of for a Prime Minister here. You decide what the ministerial code says in the first place, and you decide what sanctions should apply to those who breach it at the end of the process. But the bits in the middle, I think, really need to be conducted by somebody else. I think it's really quite invidious for a Prime Minister to try and work out whether someone's breached the ministerial code or not. And I think we were in a very unfortunate situation where Prime Ministers who were left with only one option on a breach of ministerial code scenario, which was to lose that minister, were tying themselves in knots to find a way of not finding a breach of the code in the first place, when there clearly was one. That isn't a sensible place for us to be. So I don't think that Rishi's done everything right, but I think the tone that he set is the right one, and some of the individual measures he proposes to take are also the right ones. But I don't think we're anywhere near having a full package of changes, which I think will start to address the lack of confidence the public have got, which Tim, I think, has clearly demonstrated in his presentation.
That's really interesting. Can I take you right back to the start of what you were saying there, where I think you said that you felt that the breaches, misbehaviour, whatever you want to describe it, of Boris Johnson reflected unfairly on other members of the government and the party. And just ask you about Conservative Party processes for dealing with standards and ethics, because it seems to me that this is, and not just the Conservative Party, but seeing I'm talking to you, this is an outstanding area, and Esther might want to come on to this afterwards, where there just isn't transparency and there isn't a great deal of confidence in the processes that parties have in place to investigate alleged breaches of rules. Are you comfortable that the Conservative Party's processes are in the right place?
Well, I think everybody's processes are capable of improvement. That certainly includes the Conservative Party's. I think there is a difficulty here which we need to face up to, and that is that there is always pressure for instant judgment on all questions, frankly, in modern politics, but particularly on standards questions. When there's an allegation made, the first instinct is to say, right, that person must be immediately suspended, we must stop them doing their job in lots of respects, we must reach an instinctive judgment about whether they are responsible for doing what they're accused of doing or not. There is an inherent natural justice problem there. It is important to recognise that not every allegation made against a public figure, especially a politician who inspires strong views for and against because of what they believe, not every allegation made against them will end up being true. And it's important that those people, in fairness to them and in fairness to a process that is going to stand up to scrutiny, has the chance to be judged fairly. And what that means is that it may take a bit of time, actually, to get to the bottom of whether or not that allegation is true. Yes, of course, every party must take precautionary measures, and that's why you see people losing the whip or being suspended from different positions pending an inquiry. But I think we must be cautious not to assume that all allegations will be proven true, and not to assume that politicians deserve a lower standard of natural justice than everybody else. Because if we do make that assumption, what will happen is that we will start to reinforce this downward spiral we're in about public confidence in politics, because good people will not come forward to be politicians. There are enough disincentives now, I have to tell you. And if we add to the list the idea that if anything is alleged against you, the assumption will be that you are guilty until proven innocent, then even fewer of those good people will come forward. And even more of what I again maintain, and I hope Nick doesn't disagree, is a majority of politicians across the political spectrum who are good people doing things for good reasons, a lot more of those people will choose to leave. So I accept, of course, that there is huge concern about standards. And I accept that there are several substantive things that have to be done to improve our performance as individual parties and collectively as a political class. But I caution against the assumption that everything must get harsher and everything must get quicker in judging guilt or innocence in a politically charged environment, which is what we live in. So not perfect, but I think there are some cautionary notes to strike as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think I completely agree with most of that. I do think that there's a separate question about transparency of processes. Like, if people had a better understanding of what the processes are that parties are using,
yeah.
And when things are under investigation, you're absolutely right, they should take their due time and to be done fairly and so on. But the lack of transparency, I think, is a separate issue.
Yes, it is. And again, transparency of process compared to transparency of the evidence that the process is considering
exactly.
are two different things. And of course, it shouldn't really be for political parties to be final judge and arbiter of decisions to be taken about sitting members of Parliament. We have in the House of Commons a structure of a Standards and Privileges Committee that must consider whether people have broken the rules at the House of Commons. That isn't party political, scrupulously not so, and quite rightly. And I think, as we've discussed, though ministers are, of course, inherently party political, judgments about the behaviour of ministers should not, in my view, ultimately be made by party politicians either. There should be an independent structure. And as I say, I'm agnostic, I have to say, about ethics commissions, but I think where Nick and I would agree is that whoever does the deciding, they must not be the politician with political skin in the game of deciding whether someone stays in office or not, or at least, forgive me, whether they have breached the code or not. I think staying in office is a matter for the Prime Minister in the end, for which he or she is politically accountable, of course.
Thanks. Esther, there were a few issues there you might want to pick up on, and we've moved a little bit into the space of talking about Parliament and standards in Parliament, which I know is something that you've done a lot of work on. What do you think, sort of from two sides, what should the parties be doing to improve Parliament's ability to bolster standards? And on the other, from the other point of view, what should Parliament be doing on this front, would you say?
Well, it was really interesting to hear Jeremy speak about that because it was actually something I was hoping to pick up on Nick because we have ended up in this slightly strange situation where about 6 years ago there was a far more established process to complain to the parties than there was to Parliament. And now, with the introduction of ICGS, we've seen that system become embedded, for better or worse. Obviously, there are criticisms of the system which are valid. But I think we've seen in the most serious cases that there has been a sort of transparent outcome which is published and has consequences in terms of then potentially going back to voters to decide whether this is something they want an MP to be kicked out for. And now that seems to compare quite kind of jarringly with the party processes where it feels now like a complaint goes in and then we sort of hear nothing for a very long time. And then there's a sort of quiet, upheld or rejected. Or, I mean, actually, I don't know if... I can't think of a recent upheld party complaint being made public. As Hannah mentioned, I think it would be incredibly desirable just for people to understand and for it to be public, what happens in that process and what are these steps that are followed before we do or don't get some kind of outcome and how will that outcome be communicated? Because often that's not very clear either. So I think that's something for the parties to consider. And in terms of Parliament, I know there's a lot of work going on already, sort of preparing for a new intake and trying to ensure that the resources are there for new MPs to be kind of brought up to speed with all of the different quite complicated to understand different sets of rules. But I think one of the things that I'm sort of left with from particularly hearing Jeremy speak is this problem that ethics and standards are obviously something everyone comes into public life, well, hopefully comes into public life aiming to uphold. Every Prime Minister wants to uphold it. Rishi Sunak, in particular, came in saying he was going to sort of start a new chapter. But I think successive governments have suffered from the fact that there always seems to be more pressing business. And it always kind of goes to the bottom of the pile. And I think that's what we're dealing with now, with some of these agreed changes now not coming through. And I just wonder whether there will be the kind of the will and the energy for the next government, whoever that is, to sort of bring that to the top of the pile again, particularly when there are going to be so many other pressures on them. And I guess I wanted to kind of throw that back to Nick and say, like, is it seen as a sort of year one commitment?
I think it's a really good question, and I think the Labour Party has seen in recent weeks with the Angela Rayner allegations that, you know, sometimes the things you want to be talking about are the things you don't get to talk about if there's an ethics issue. So how can you convince us that the will would be there under a Labour government really to prioritise this stuff?
No, it is a hugely significant priority, and if you look at the number of times that Keir Starmer has referred to this as a huge priority, you will see that. And I think it was significant, as I indicated in my, you know, my first answer, Hannah, that the New Year's speech that Keir gave identified standards in public life as a huge priority. Now, of course, governments do get blown off course by events. I don't think there is a government I can think of since 1945 that didn't have something significant happen to it that its members didn't expect. And of course, that is always the case. But politics is ultimately about choices, and that's the point, isn't it? You, of course, certain things are thrust upon you as a government you have to deal with, but you choose to make ethics and standards a priority, and that's precisely what Keir Starmer has done.
Yeah, I mean, I think every politician, as you say, Esther, will come in saying, oh, I believe in standards, and I think we're going to clean the stables, we're going to make sure this is much better under us, and then they get distracted, just as you say. I think you're absolutely right. The reason that I think politicians coming into government in particular have to think very carefully about this is that if you look at the experience of not just the last government, but most successively of the last few governments, what you find is that standard storms throw them completely off course. And one of the best reasons for worrying about standards and how to maintain them systematically is it stops you being massively distracted by a complete standards fiasco on a particular individual case, which then consumes all your political attention. And most of us who've been in and around government know that because of the things that Nick has described that happen to every government, Number 10 often has a grid, a plan, a strategy that it can't deliver because something's happened that consumes all its attention. And the number of times that is standards related is disturbingly high. So if nothing else, as a government, if you want to implement your strategy, if you want to stick to your grid, and we all know how keen they are to stick to the grid, then try and deal with as many of the potential threats to that in advance as you possibly can. And actually, one of the benefits of having an independent structure for determining whether, for example, the ministerial code has been broken or not, is a Prime Minister can say, well, this is not for me to do. I've got an independent structure to do this, and I'm going to pass it on to them. I'm going to get on with some other things. That's far more productive for a Prime Minister. By the way, it's also worth saying that for any government, incumbent or soon to arrive, it's also worth recognising what else high standards on standards delivers for you. And I think it's something we don't speak about enough. It isn't just a nice to have this. It doesn't just make us feel good and ethically pure. It also has an effect on the UK PLC bottom line. The reason that the UK does so well in several very significant respects, legal services being a good example, is that we have a reputation for very high moral and ethical standards. The reason that people bring inward investment to this country is substantially because they don't think the government is going to nick their money and nationalise what they invest in. I'm not sure they're right now, but we'll see. But I do think that there are several things that a high standards ethical regime delivers for you that are far from a warm, fuzzy feeling and are about cold, hard cash and about the ability of this country to compete internationally. And I think we need to probably say much more about that than we do so that people can understand why this matters and why, therefore, politicians in government or in opposition prioritise it more than they currently are able to do.
That's a really important point. Nick, can I ask you a devolution question? And just relating to what Jeremy said about new people coming into government and having their agenda potentially derailed by ethical questions. Labour's in government in Wales. We have a new First Minister, Vaughan Gething, who's facing calls for investigation into a donation he received for his leadership campaign. How would that be investigated under your independent commission? And do you think the government in Wales should be setting up something similar?
So, I should just say on Angela Rayner, by the way, every confidence in Angela Rayner, but obviously we'll have to allow Greater Manchester Police to investigate and the investigation to take its course, but every confidence in her. Look, in respect, let me just take the devolution question in stages, because there's a number of aspects to that. Look, I am a great believer in devolution, and if we are privileged enough to form a government, I want to have a genuine partnership approach. So, of course, our creation of an Ethics and Integrity Commission, if there are areas of overlap, if there are aspects that the Welsh Government thinks would be helpful for them to adopt, then, of course, we are more than happy to have that discussion. But it is a devolved administration, and how they choose to police ethics and standards is a matter for them, and quite rightly so it should be. In terms of the donation, there is no suggestion, as the rules currently stand, that Vaughan Gething has broken any rules. The donation is entirely transparent. It was declared on time and is there for everybody to see. Now, what Vaughan Gething also said in the leadership campaign is that he would listen to people and not lecture them. And because of the concerns that have been raised, he has set out and set up a review of the rules around this. That review will publish its findings in the autumn. I think that's a perfectly reasonable decision that I support him taking. But it should be pointed out there is no even suggested rule breach on this donation.
OK. I think I'm going to have to let other people ask questions, much as I would like to continue asking them myself. So my colleague Lauren has a microphone. I'll also take some questions which we have coming through online. Can we have the person over here in the animal print? We'll take them in groups of three.
Hi. I suppose it's a general question and a sort of bit of observation. But I mean, I think this is a hugely important issue. But a lot of your politicians in central government come in via various means. They've often been in local government. There are different levels of government and public bodies and all the rest of it. So I think this equally applies to that. You mentioned Sue Gray's comment about there being insufficient support for whistleblowers, and I'm not quite sure where speaking truth to power turns into whistleblowing. But a lot of people, particularly in middle management, are in very isolated roles trying to speak truth to power, to give the advice to people who they might not agree with, but it's their job to help that person elected or appointed to do their job. But it can get very difficult when they are perhaps in a position of that. And if you take that example, say, back to City Hall, no one can say the signs weren't there before Boris Johnson became an MP for the second time. No, I'm not trying to make... I mean, you know, I could say lots of things, lots of people could, but the signs were there. When he was in City Hall, he had a very strong support, people behind the scenes able to speak truth to power. It didn't control some of the things or some of the advisers.
You have a question.
Yeah, and the question is, what would you do to support people at the lower levels, because that's where people start to make that they learn the behaviour and they observe it. Sorry, but I just wanted to put that in the context.
Thank you. Gentleman in the navy suit.
Hi, Dave Penman, General Secretary of the FDA. When it comes to ministerial misconduct, all roads end up leading to the Prime Minister. Yet we've had the last two occasions that the independent advisor investigated ministers for bullying. On one occasion, the Prime Minister refused to acknowledge the evidence and refused with Boris Johnson with Priti Patel. And then the second occasion with Dominic Raab, Rishi Sunak refused to make a decision. He didn't make a decision despite the evidence, and he allowed Dominic Raab to resign. So is it possible and preferable to actually have a system that does not eventually simply allow Prime Ministers to make that political decision around the choices on the punishment for the ministerial code? Because I think, as you said, Jeremy, they do have skin in the game when it comes to the politics of why they may want to ignore all of the evidence that's put in front of them.
Thank you. I'm just here.
Thank you, Duncan Haynes, Transparency International UK. A lot of the conversation has been about how we respond when someone appears to have done something wrong. But what could our democratic institutions, and indeed to the politicians on the panel, your own political parties, be doing to help prevent your own colleagues, the people you put up for election, going off the rails in the first place?
Great, thank you. Just because of shortness of time, I'm going to try and direct these questions, but don't let that stop you answering ones which I've not directed to you. Esther, I feel as though you spend quite a lot of time as a journalist talking to people who, for whatever reason, find themselves frustrated by the systems they're operating within, that whistleblowing systems don't work for them or whatever, and they end up coming to you. What would you say are the priorities to be put in place by the parties or whoever else to support those sorts of people?
I think... Unfortunately, it's not rocket science, it's not a magic formula, but I think most MPs individually know kind of whether they support their staff and try to have an open attitude. And I think that is kind of the most important thing if we're talking about people at Westminster, because that means that A, they are probably fostering a healthy kind of workplace culture in their office. It also means that potentially staff will feel empowered to raise concerns. And I think that is so important, not only when things go seriously wrong, but if you have that kind of dialogue with people working at the lower levels in a party or in parliament, it can prevent things going seriously wrong, because it means lower level concerns can be raised in a more kind of informal, constructive way, and it doesn't end up in some sort of serial bullying case. So that would be my sort of two pennies worth on Parliament. But yeah.
Tim, can I come to you on the prevention question? Must scandal and the finding out of allegations of wrongdoing always be the catalyst? What more could be being done to prevent problems in the first place?
So I think it's a really good question. I think I was thinking sort of one theme throughout all of those questions is about tone from the top, right? So talking slightly to Esther's point about, you know, the role of an MP in their office of setting the right tone, but also to the points that's already been discussed about the Prime Minister within a government setting the right tone. I think that is hugely important. And it goes to Jeremy's point earlier about, you know, under Boris Johnson, there was an almost sort of an accepted way of doing things, which a different Prime Minister would not have that same way of doing things. The problem you then have is it comes down to that individual, and there's no sort of systemic way of making it better. So I think the fact that people do clearly care about this, the fact that this has been in the news for so long, what it shows what the incentives for politicians are to try and meet standards, because we do live in a democracy, and the ultimate test of any politician is the ballot box, and I think that's always got to be the way. So I disagree with Dave. I think the Prime Minister does have to be the person who makes the final decision on people's political careers within government, because of they are the person who is elected. And I think the media plays an important role. a lot of, I can't remember who it was, which story it was, but someone made the point that actually a lot of the wrongdoing we found out about in government recently hasn't been because of the various systems that exist. It hasn't been because of the independent advisor or ACIBA or anything. It's been because of media reports. And so that kind of external pressure on people is a huge part of it. But yeah, it's not an easy question. I don't have a good answer, I'm afraid.
So Jeremy, can I put Dave's question to you? I think you've made quite clear in your remarks already that you feel that ultimately the selection of who is in cabinet must be for the Prime Minister. But what is your answer to the critique of the way the system appeared to really sort of creak at the seams when you had allegations against a Prime Minister? It surely can't be adequate to just say, well, let's hope we don't get someone with the same attitude towards the rules again. Like, what should we do?
No, it isn't adequate to do that. And I take Dave's point, and he's had first-hand experience of how difficult it's been for his members when these things have happened, and I respect that. But I think there is something difficult about this, particularly because we're dealing with people who are democratically elected, as Tim says. And the danger for any standards consideration of bad behaviour among members of parliament, ministers, prime ministers even, is you have to recognise they represent people as well as stand in an individual position for themselves. Therefore, actions you take against them, punishments you impose upon them, particularly where you are limiting their capacity to do their job, have reverberations on the people that they represent. There is then the additional point that Tim mentions, which is that I think in the end, it has to be for the Prime Minister to decide who serves in the Prime Minister's government. It is a very revolutionary concept that somebody who is arbitrating on a standards question should be able to conclude that not just an elected member of parliament, but a minister in a government should no longer hold that position. And I don't think that is something we can ask a standards body to do. However, what we've got now is there are too many variables. There are too many questions left to the politicians. I don't think it is possible to find a way of avoiding the last question, which is, should that person lose their job in government or not, being a political decision, a decision made by a politician. But the decisions leading up to that most certainly shouldn't be. At the moment, they are. So the reason that we're all talking, I think, about the ideas of making sure that decisions as to whether the ministerial code is breached or not are decisions made not by the Prime Minister, but by an independent advisor, a commission, whatever it may be, is that it will make it then progressively harder for the Prime Minister to avoid taking the appropriate action against someone who has been found to breach the ministerial code. And we won't have a repeat of what I think was really the unconscionable position of Prime Ministers trying to find ways of saying what was clearly a breach of the ministerial code wasn't a breach of the ministerial code because they didn't want to lose that minister. And it's his right to say that not every breach, I think Esther made this point earlier, not every breach of the ministerial code should result in the removal from office. There are lots of things ministers can do wrong that they should be accountable for and should be punished for, but it doesn't necessarily mean they have to lose their job in government. And I think giving a graded list of sanctions is sensible, but it should go along with the handing over of responsibility for arbitrating on breaches of the ministerial code to someone other than the Prime Minister, because I don't think anyone but the Prime Minister can decide on ultimate sanctions. So, look, I get your frustration, Dave, I really do. But I think, in the end, we just have to have that feature in our system. Where we can influence the process is in the earlier stages.
And all that works perfectly until it's the Prime Minister who, at the end of the day, is determining whether the breach of the code applies to themselves.
That's right. But keep in mind, Boris Johnson is not Prime Minister today. And most people would agree, substantially the reason for that is because of his approach to standards questions, not just the ones we've been talking about. And so there is, in the end, political accountability for politicians. That's as it should be. And so I don't think we've seen, you know, in all the unhappy history of the last few years, a failure for ultimate accountability to catch up in the end. We might all have wished it did so earlier, but it does happen. And in the end, that is the way in which ultimate accountability has to be applied. But there are lots of things we can do to make this system better than it is. And I think actually what you're seeing is there's a remarkable amount of consensus about how you do that. We've just now got to get on and make it happen.
Nick, can I combine a couple of those questions to you? So you've talked about your Ethics Commission and that being the mechanism really that kicks in if there's an allegation, if there's a breach, if we got to that stage. But what would a Labour government do about preventing problems happening in the first place, and as part of that, supporting people who might be trying to whistleblow within systems and so on?
Yeah, on the whistleblowing, I do think there needs to be a formal process. And I think you raised two separate issues there, actually, because one, I think, was about civil servants having the confidence to speak truth to ministers, which I think is of fundamental importance to our constitutional arrangement and how it works. The second issue I think you were referring to is where you have far more junior staff members, actually, who might not have the confidence of the perm secs and the DGs and the front office, all the more senior civil service. I think in those cases, we do need to have a proper formal process that gives people the protection that they need to bring forward issues that are then treated seriously and sensitively as they should be. And I think, as you referred to, Hannah, Sue Gray has spoken about that quite publicly as well, which I think is very important. On prevention of issues, I actually think the next general election is quite fundamental to this. Because if there is going to be a large number of new members of Parliament, I obviously hope there's going to be a lot of new Labour members of Parliament, but whatever way you look at it, if you look at the numbers of MPs who are standing down as well, there is going to be a huge turnover. This is going to be one of the elections. You may even find half of the MPs are new after this election. And from the point of view, from a party political point of view, we are looking very carefully at the support that our prospective parliamentary candidates are getting. I mean, it's one of the things, when I became a Member of Parliament in 2015, I'd previously been a barrister, as you may have gathered from some of the earlier discussion. But, you know, I had run things before. I chaired the management committee of chambers where I had, and I was surprised when I came to Parliament. When I was in chambers, I had a HR function. I had lots of other functions that I could refer to for support that would assist you. And I think with new MPs, you are in effect running this little office where lots of people have done things that are completely different in life and they don't quite have the experience to do it. And I think we really do need, in answer to Duncan's question, to be putting in place support at that stage, at that very early stage, as to how you run. The point that Esther was making about fostering a culture where people feel they can raise things informally and you will actually act on them, I think that's the point at which we need to provide an awful lot of support. And I think there's an opportunity to do it at this election.
I just wanted to ask the two MPs here, well, I have the chance. Do you think there is something going wrong with the party complaint processes, particularly, I'm afraid, thinking of Labour here at the moment, because we've recently had a former chief quit the party after saying he was denied justice?
I don't know about the individual case. I'm sure you wouldn't want me to comment on the individual case without knowledge. I think, look, there are two parallel processes here. There's obviously the ICGS scheme, which is run quite properly independently of party within Parliament. I do think that's an improvement on what went before, but ultimately we have to listen to the complainants, we have to listen to the victims as to whether there should be changes to that. With regard to the party processes, I think it's important that the evidence within that process is considered by the appropriate committees and that the complainants get the confidentiality that they need. And look, I'm often asked questions about the length of time these processes take. And of course, what often happens is you have lawyers involved. The lawyers will agree a timetable between them. The timetables will differ case to case because, you know, collection of evidence. In terms of the timetable, lawyers agree, the complexity of the particular case. All these things mean that you do get processes that run differently. But ultimately, yes, the answer to your question is, I think our processes have been made far better by Keir Starmer. But ultimately on that process, or indeed the parliamentary process, for me, you listen to the voice of the victims in the system. And it's them that I would want to listen to as to how they found it in terms of their ability to be confident that what they'd said was treated confidentially, sensitively and fairly. And I think what we will continue to do is to absolutely do that and keep our processes under review.
I'm going to use chair's privilege to say we're going to run over 10 minutes so I can do another round of questions. If anyone needs to go, please feel free to sneak out. I've got one question online from Sadie, who says, having recently, and I think this is a question for the two politicians, having recently written my undergraduate dissertation on ethical standards in government, I found many young people feel cynical and lack trust in politicians given recent behavioural scandals. How do we address this before the election? That's a question from Sadie, and I'll take two more from the room. Gentleman here.
William Wallace, House of Lords. I just want to ask how you propose to introduce the changes in standards, which may be... If I were a new government, I would want any changes to the current system to be as non-party, cross-party as possible, to embed them in a system which would last longer than just the next government. Yeah. I note that John Bowers in the Telegraph last week said what we need is either a Speaker's Conference or another commission, and that sounds to me like endangering slowing it down too much. But the question, the process whereby you strengthen the current system is as important in some ways as what you actually do.
Very good point. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Sue Hawley from Spotlight on Corruption. I had two questions. I mean, obviously, a lot of the recommendations that we have consensus around came from CSPL in the first place. Should there be a mechanism whereby CSPL's reports actually must be taken into account and acted on? Because as we know, the government cherry-picked, rather, which bits of it it would take on board. And my second question is, which you may have a view on, Sir Jeremy, is whether standards are really being done on the cheap in the UK. I mean, really compared to what other countries spend, such as Canada and Australia, we are really spending very little, and it is potentially causing problems with delays in appointments and business appointment rules. Thank you.
Great. Excellent set of questions. Nick, can I start with you?
Well, I'll pick up the point about changes and cross-party consensus, which I think is a very interesting point. I think in terms of governments, ultimately with governments, what they do is... I always think the test is... It's embedded if when a government from the opposite party comes back to power, it accepts the change that's been made. I think that's ultimately the test of whether you've embedded something in our politics. Now, each prime minister since 1945 has... I mean, it used to be questions of procedure for ministers rather than ministerial code, but since Attlee issued his questions of procedure for ministers in July of 1945, each of them gets to do that. And I do think that's important because it's for the Prime Minister ultimately to set the standard from the top. And I don't think I'm proposing the Prime Minister should bind a future Prime Minister on their code. However, some of the other things that we are referring to here, in terms of, for example, the standards of behaviour we expect from MPs, second jobs I was referring to in my earlier answer, they are properly matters for the House of Commons. They are not actually, the government can't come and impose on MPs actually these things. And that's where I think that cross-party consensus is absolutely vital. And that's why some of the issues that we've discussed will properly, if Labour is privileged to form a government, will be matters for the House of Commons and will, I hope, be things that will, you know, no parliament can bind its successor, but I hope they will be legacies to future generations of MPs, that this is an agreed set of standards that we can all adhere to, that actually not just helps MPs individually, but it helps the reputation of politics.
And Sadie's question, what would Labour do, should Labour do between now and the election to promote confidence in politics?
Well, look, we can only continue between now and the election to make the case for the importance of standards to the next Labour government. But ultimately, whatever we say, however we seek to persuade, we'll have to show it as a government to people. I did, though, in terms of Sadie's question about young people, I often get the question. I visit every secondary school in my constituency throughout every year, and that's often put to me. And my point back always is, you know, to young people passionate about making change, one way to do it is actually get involved.
True. Esther, What do you think about this question about what parties could be doing now? I mean, I think I feel as though Nick's absolutely right in terms of people judge parties on their actions rather than their words. But, of course, there are always ethical questions, live ethical questions in every party at every time. It's not only when you're in government that that's that you can demonstrate.
Yeah, and I think for good reasons we spoke that a lot about systems and moving to statutory footing for certain reforms that have already been agreed. But I do think there is still a really important role for informal relationships in that regard, particularly whipping, when it functions well, can be a force for good, and there is a pastoral element to it. It is really important. I think, unfortunately, what we see when a government is potentially coming to the end of its time, there are a lot of divisions, a lot of competing interests, that bit of the whipping function kind of gets lost. But if there is a kind of approach of people in the party all being in touch with others, keeping an eye on people who are maybe coming up through the ranks or standing for election for the first time, that kind of relationship where people feel looked after and looked out for, I think, will be important for the new intake coming in.
That's a really interesting point. And gives Tim a chance to do a little plug for an event we have next week on WIPs.
I think maybe this Tuesday lunchtime next week, we're talking about WIPs and how the role has changed and how WIPs in the next parliament might have to act differently. So, yeah, do join us then.
Tim, can I give you a last word to talk? I'll come, of course, to you, Jeremy, but your last word, Tim. This question about, really interesting question from Sue about, are we trying to have a standard system on the cheap?
I mean, I haven't looked into how much it costs, which is a failure of the IFG. We should know how much this stuff costs, but it's not expensive, right? It's sort of tens of officials. It's, you know, a few commissioners. It's not a lot of money in the grand scheme of the £1 trillion that the government spends every year. And so I'm sure there is a case if you are sort of talking about, you know, improving things for a bit more resource. I think what Sue said was really interesting about how other countries do it. So Canada and Australia, they have, you know, obviously similar parliamentary setups, but different ways of doing things. They've got more federal systems, and the Australian states have quite strong sort of ethics arrangements. I think the other interesting place to look at is Northern Ireland, which for a long time, obviously, they didn't have the Assembly and the Executive, but it has been re-established recently. And the ethics commissioner or independent advisor there covers both MLAs and ministers in the executive. And I think looking at how they manage things is very interesting. So, yes, I'm sure we should spend more money on it, but also learn from best practice elsewhere, I think, is really important. Because the other thing I would say on that, actually, the UK is very good at criticising itself on this stuff. And actually, we are quite good in lots of ways. You know, lots of countries don't have a ministerial code. They don't have an independent advisor who has any level of independence. There are things that can be improved in Westminster, but also there are things that we do quite well.
That's a nice positive point. Thanks, Tim. Can I ask you specifically to cover any of those you want to, Jeremy, but Sue's question about automaticity of CSPL recommendations?
Yeah, so let's start with that. So instinctively, am I attracted to the idea that people should be compelled to do what I recommend? Yes, absolutely. but I think probably what has to be kept in mind is this question of democratic authority. And the truth is that the CSPL, great institution, though it undoubtedly is, and it does have some elected politicians on it, though they are not, as you know, the majority of the committee, does not have direct democratic legitimacy. No one has elected the CSPL to determine what we should do. And so I'm afraid, frustrating though it is for those of us who make these recommendations, and as you know, they are not made on a whim. They're, a lot of work is put into these reports, a lot of evidence is taken, and a lot of consideration is given, not just to what sounds good, but what might work. And so it is frustrating inevitably when you're involved in those pieces of work that all your recommendations are not taken up, or worse yet, as someone said, that the bits of them are done and bits of them are not. But I don't think we can require a democratically elected government to do something that a non-democratic body has insisted they should do. In the end, governments must decide, and in the end, the electorate will conclude whether they think government have done a good job or not. And then, working back to Sadie's question about young people being cynical about politics, and I'm completely, I mean, it's a nostalgic phrase, but I agree with Nick. And I think it is true that when you go to schools, as I do too, you find a huge amount of cynicism about this. And of course, it's found in their parents as well. So, yes, we as politicians have to do more to improve standards. We do that structurally in some of the ways we've been talking about. We do it personally, I hope, in demonstrating we're prepared to do the right thing when it counts. But if I may say so, I think Esther's profession has a responsibility here too, because if young people in particular are fed a constant diet of stories about politicians who are corrupt, who behave badly, who have their fingers in the till, who break the rules, then they will of course conclude that all politicians are like that. Esther knows, we know, that is not the truth. And as Tim says, this country is remarkably good by international standards at keeping its politics clean. And I think we have to maintain a perspective on this. Yes, of course, we must discuss, as we have today, how to improve our standards and never get complacent about them. We have no right to be complacent. But we should also give people a more rounded perspective on just what's going on in politics. And if all they hear is the bad news, don't be surprised when they form a judgment based purely on the bad news. And then finally, on William Wallace's point, I think there is more cross-party consensus on this than people think. And as you know, and we know as politicians, politicians' greatest kept secret is that we agree more than we disagree on a lot of things. And so the structure, as you say, matters. And the speed at which you can make that structure work matters. So almost the grander the structure and the more authority you seek to invest in it, the longer it takes to come to a conclusion. And that's the trade-off that has to be made on questions like this. But I think actually, and again, you know, I would hope my party isn't, if there is a Labour government in that unlikely event, that we won't die in a ditch on the question of whether there should be an independent commission to do these things. What matters far more is what it does and how it does it. And on that, there ought to be greater consensus surfaced, because I think it is there under the surface. And we have talked already about some of the things on which there is already consensus. Let's not try and elevate the differences. Let's try and elevate the agreements. And let's get on and do those things where we agree, because those will, I think, make a significant difference.
Thank you. I mean, I think the CSPL itself is, of course, a good example of a mechanism set up which has managed to build and sustain enough cross-party consensus in its value that it has continued in existence, despite being set up in quite political circumstances by John Major. And just reflecting on what Sue said there, I do think early in its history, there was much more of a sense that the recommendations that came from the CSPL would, as a matter of course, be implemented, if we look at their recommendations that they made around the parliamentary standard system, around electoral commission and so on. And so I wonder whether there is something to reflect on around the way in which the CSPL sets its own agenda, but is how parties engage with that when it says, you know, we're now going to do a big piece of work on this, whether there could be a greater sense of, well, parties really are going to take seriously what comes from this and want to seek to find a cross-party consensus around implementing whatever comes out. Anyway, having given myself the final word, I think it just remains to say there will be a recording of this event on our website very shortly, so you can all watch it back. And recommend it to your friends. But in the meantime, will you just join me in thanking an excellent panel?